From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Anthony Boza has spent a good part of his life in the trenches of the war against crime. He's the former chief of police for the Bronx and Minneapolis. On this edition of Fresh Air, a top cop's perspective on urban crime. Also today, coffee, how to buy it, how to brew it, and what the medical experts have to say about it. Some advice from food writer Corby Kummer. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of two little-known Schubert masses. And Maureen Carrigan wonders why so many writers get misty-eyed about baseball. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has broken off an 18-month dialogue with the Palestine Liberation Organization. The president said today that talks with the PLO will be suspended until the group shows that it's working to resolve problems relating to terrorism, including last month's attempted attack on an Israeli beach resort. The Bush administration has insisted that the PLO denounce the attack and take measures against Abu Labas, the PLO faction leader who was behind it. Mr. Bush said today that a PLO statement denouncing attacks against civilians was not sufficient to meet U.S. terms for a continuation of diplomatic talks. The Soviet Republic of Uzbekistan has issued what it calls a Declaration of Sovereignty, which the TASS news agency reports is intended to take its place within the framework of a renewed Soviet federation. The BBC's Kevin Connolly reports from Moscow.
The TASS report says the Uzbek parliament passed the new act only after heated debate. Some deputies had hoped to postpone consideration of the issue of independence until after Mr. Gorbachev has produced his proposals for a new Treaty of Union, redefining the relationship between Moscow and all the republics. But in the end, what TASS described as a declaration of sovereignty was approved, an act which will have the effect of giving Uzbek laws primacy over those of the Soviet Union. All domestic and foreign matters, it says, are now under the control of Uzbekistan. In making its declaration, the Uzbek Assembly has stopped short of the challenge to central Soviet authority posed by the Baltic republics. But the wording of the new law is reminiscent of an act passed by the Russian Federation earlier this month, and it does add the voice of Uzbekistan to the growing chorus of republics demanding a revision of the Treaty of Union.
The BBC's Kevin Connolly reporting from Moscow. Secretary of State James Baker is heading for East Berlin, where he'll sound out the Soviets and Western foreign ministers on an aid package to help the Soviet economy. Barry Schweid has more.
The main business in the East German capital is a 2+4 meeting. That's the monthly gathering of the four World War II allies, the U.S., the Soviet Union, Britain, and France, plus the two Germanys, to talk about Germany's future. That future, Baker insists, must include NATO membership for the merged and stronger Germany. That prospect makes the Soviets and a lot of other Europeans nervous. So West Germany and France, with U.S. approval, are putting together a package to help the Soviet economy, thereby hoping to buy Kremlin acquiescence. There won't be any final decision in East Berlin, but that could come in just a couple of weeks when the seven leading industrialized countries hold a summit in Houston, Texas. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Stock prices edged up slightly on Wall Street today in the third straight day of light trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 2 points to close at 2,895.3. Declines led advances by a margin of 7-6. This is NPR News. A convicted drug dealer testified today that he smoked crack cocaine with Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry and that the two conspired to hide their drug use from the police. Charles Lewis, who's testifying for the prosecution under a plea bargain, acknowledged that he lied about Barry's alleged drug use to police in 1988 and to a grand jury in 1989. Barry's on trial on 14 counts of drug use and perjury. If he's convicted on all charges, he could be sentenced to as much as 26 years in prison and almost $2 million in fines. A fire and explosion on board the aircraft carrier Midway injured 16 American sailors and left two missing. Pentagon officials say the carrier was taking part in routine operations when the incident occurred. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Midway was in the Sea of Japan about 125 miles from its home port, Yokosuka, when the explosion occurred. The blast was traced to a room that ironically held firefighting equipment. After the first explosion, there was a second blast, followed by a fire that took 10 hours to extinguish. The Navy says the cause of the accident is under investigation. The Midway, commissioned in 1945 and modernized twice since then, is the oldest carrier in the Navy's fleet. Residents of Yokosuka, fearing the ship may be carrying nuclear weapons, say the Midway should remain at sea until its safety is assured. The accident also renewed concern in this country over the safety of Navy ships. Since last October, 14 persons have been killed in naval accidents, most in a three-week span last fall. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Federal prosecutors agreed today to release up to $6 million of Manuel Noriega's bank accounts. The agreement resolves a legal battle over how the former Panamanian leader would pay for his defense on drug charges. The agreement came as the Panamanian government announced it will sue Noriega in civil court for more than $5 billion. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Anthony Boza looks at crime from the perspective of 36 years as a cop. He rose through the ranks in New York to the position of police commissioner of the Bronx, which includes some of the most bombed-out and dangerous urban areas in America. Then as deputy chief of the New York City Transit Police, he covered perhaps the most dangerous subway system in America. In 1979, he went to Minneapolis, where he served for 9 years as the police commissioner. He was known as a liberal reform commissioner. But he says his shakeups cost him the support of the force. Boza once joked to a Minnesota newspaper, morale had never been higher. The cops all hate their chief. Boza is retired from police work and now serves as Minnesota's gaming commissioner. He's written a new book about cops, crime, and the criminal justice system called The Police Mystique. He writes, until the overclass learns they're creating the muggers, rapists, druggies, and the murderers that terrify them, nothing much will be done to stem the tide of violence.
Look around you, 35 million people below the poverty level. We can now speak of a certain class warfare between the underclass and the overclass. Look at the homeless, the hungry, the unsheltered, the naked. Look at the streets of Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, full of people from the underclass. The state does nothing about it. By the state, I mean the federal and state and local governments. We're not building housing. We're welfare is out of the is a forgotten issue. The war on poverty has been declared lost and over. And the whole debate now centers on such issues as obsessed the 1988 presidential debate over Willie Horton. George Bush said, well, here is a black monster. Let's destroy him. Appeal, pandering to our worst racist instincts. And not to mention the fact that he had raped a white woman, you know, just a wonderful symbol for him. And Dukakis basically agreed with it. He basically said that he would destroy that black monster a little more humanely. But the metaphor that works is, could George Bush and Michael Dukakis and Tony Boza be the Dr. Frankensteins that created this monster through neglect and indifference and hostility and racism and the disabilities of poverty that we visited upon the underclass?
Okay, so you have a social analysis.
Yes.
About how the poor get poor and stay
poor. A boring social analysis, we might say.
Well, what do you do with the social analysis on a day-to-day level when you're a police chief? I mean, you have to take action
that's
on a day-to-day level.
Yeah,
so,
that's a good question.
Yeah.
You do exactly what the Vietnam generals did not do. The Vietnam generals fought the war, asked for more time, more treasure, more youth, and we'll take care of it, but they never informed us as to the backdrop, as to the reality, as to the moral issues and the consequences of their actions. They never gave us a thoughtful analysis. It was mindless, reflective activism, and it led to tragedy and defeat. The police chiefs have to fight that war. They have to make arrests, respond to calls for emergencies, issue traffic citations, put down riots. But then they have to report to us as to what they know when they see. Now, every police chief in the United States that I know of believes that summer riots are coming, long, hot summers. They see a combustible mixture of disaffection in the ghetto waiting for a spark. In Detroit, it was the NBA championship. The Pistons won the championship, and the ghetto residents decided to riot. Internally, we are disintegrating in poverty, criminality, violence, guns, drugs, a Holocaust, an urban Holocaust. And that's what's going to destroy the nation And the police are basically irrelevant to crime. After all, we deal with Willie Horton only after he commits crimes. How about the upstream question? Where did he come from? How about prenatal care, abortion, sex education, his mother? How about the first 5 years of his life? To what degree do we nurture him or give him hope or give him education? Which is, I know what the listeners will be saying, you know, their collective eyes will be glazing over with boredom and resentment and hostility. Oh, God, another flaming liberal. But the reality is that I was a very tough law and order advocate, 36 years in three police agencies, 24 years with the New York City Police Department, the last four as Bronx police chief, then 3 years in the subway police, and that was an experience, and then 9 years as chief of police of Minneapolis. During this time, I was a very, very hard law and order advocate. I believe in capital punishment. I believe in incarcerating people. I believe in keeping the human animal under control. I believe very strongly in punishment. But I also believe in asking, where do they come from? And let's look at the upstream questions.
Probably one of the areas that has the largest underclass is the Bronx in New York, where you served as the chief of police. What are some of the unique things that you faced there as the head of police in the Bronx, do you think?
Racism, exclusion, it's interesting to see. These are people without hope. So the educational plant has given up. There are no jobs waiting, no homes, no marriage, no prospects. So they become warehouses. It's just the Bronx is America's frontier. That's where America is going to win or lose its battle for survival. And at the moment, it's losing.
People who are really poor have less to lose in a way. And there's this feeling of what can you do to me? You know, I have nothing anyways.
No. Yes, it is that. And you see that most dramatically in rioting situations where it's just pillage and burn and the vandals and Visigoths are at the gate and it doesn't matter if you shoot or arrest or whatever and they burn everything to the ground. And if they have to the next day walk a mile instead of two blocks to buy milk and bread, they'll do it.
So how do you think that affects the relationship between cops and the people of a neighborhood if that neighborhood is really poor, as you call it, the underclass? Yeah.
The police are an army of occupation in the ghetto, doing the overclass's bidding to try to keep the underclass under control and out of sight. That's basically the assignment, the tacit assignment they have. That assignment is demoralizing to the police because it's tacit. It is not spoken. The police are told very clearly and affirmatively, arrest people, respond to calls, issue traffic citations. But they are told subliminally and very subtly, keep the underclass under control, keep them out of sight if you can, just take care of them, sweep them out of the way, and there's no way they can sweep them to, so that the police become demoralized by this awful assignment that they have been given, which is tacit.
My guest is Anthony Boza, and he served as chief of police in the Bronx and in Minneapolis, and he's written a new book called The Police Mystique. When you got to Minneapolis, did you think this was going to be a piece of cake after having come from the Bronx?
Yes and no. As an administrator, no. The administrative organizational problems that I faced were vast, were tremendous. The union was running the agency. The department was demoralized and screwed up. It needed to be shaped up. So it was an organization that was in total disarray. So administratively, I saw the problem as a very, very difficult and challenging one and one that I was not entirely sure I was up to. But the reality that the cop faces on the street is completely different. That is to say, the reality that the cop faces in the Bronx is very, very dangerous every single day in every way. Junkies, burglars, arrests, rapists, fires, riots, disorders, all kinds of problems. So it's a society in dissolution. The Bronx is dissolving before your very eyes and has been. I mean, when I saw the Minneapolis ghetto, you know, it's really faded and not particularly great one-family houses with lawns and trees and space. I was really astounded. It sure wasn't the Bronx. So the reality that the cop faced on the street was very different. The administrative challenges that I faced were very, very difficult.
You've said that your main regret when you were police chief in Minnesota was your inability to gain the affection of your troops.
Yes.
Why do you think you never got it?
Because I made a decision when I began as chief of police and had as an executive always, You have to make a decision whether you're going to accommodate the comfort and convenience of your colleagues or whether you're going to serve the people. And if you serve the people, you're going to make your colleagues' lives less comfortable. They're going to work harder. They're going to confront more dangerous situations. They're going to work weekends. They're going to work summers. It's going to be a strain. And you're constantly forcing them to do things that are inconvenient or harsh or difficult. And that went on for 9 years, and their antipathy grew. And at the end, if anything, I had less affection from the ranks than I did at the beginning. I would only add in balance that the people of Minneapolis treated me with enormous affection. They treated me far better than I deserved throughout.
Why do you think it's mutually exclusive, you know, serving the police and catering to the needs of the community?
Well, you know, I like to deal in real politics, in the real world. Public figures today like to say a lot of bland things and have it every which way and have two number one priorities and all of that. The reality is that in my experience, and maybe this speaks to a paucity of wit or intellect on my part, I was never able to reconcile the two ideas of accommodating the comfort and convenience of my police colleagues and at the same time serving the people more effectively. I hired women and minorities. I reduced the upper rank levels really very dramatically in the process deprived them of upward mobility. We went from 23 high-ranking officials to 12. I disciplined them very severely for acts of brutality and corruption. I broke up two-person patrols and made them one-person patrol. I held them accountable for the use of their powers. I constantly examined the use of their powers. It was a very open system. The press was able to crawl all over the department and ask anyone any question they wanted whenever they felt like it, a totally open system. It had a very, very unnerving effect on the troops, and they hated every moment of it, and I didn't know any way to reconcile. And I know that the temptation is to say, well, it can be done, it can be reconciled. In fact, I never found a way to reconcile the public interest with the comfort and convenience of my colleagues.
My guest is Anthony Boza, and he served as chief of police in the Bronx and in Minneapolis, and he's written a new book called The Police Mystique. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Anthony Boza is my guest. Let's talk about some of the typical dilemmas now in urban downtowns around the country and get your perspective as a former police commissioner of, you know, Minneapolis and the Bronx.
Right.
One of the great problems is homelessness now. There are, you know, people without homes.
Sure.
Many of them live in neighborhoods. Many of them can be seen living on vents, living on street corners in the downtowns of urban neighborhoods. Now, as a police commissioner, what did you tell your men about how they should treat the men and women who had no place to go and were living on the streets?
What did I tell my men and women? I had plenty of women in policing today, whereas this was not always the case. Thank heaven for it. I think they've been a great addition. What I told them was to enforce the law and that not to do anything that was not legal. So we could not make them invisible. We could not move them about and displace them. Their rights had to be protected because the rights of the least are as important as the rights of the strongest, but that I would not tolerate public drunkenness or urinating on the sidewalk or importuning little old ladies on the street, and that they would be arrested and taken to detox centers, and that there would be strict accountability. There would be no public peddling because peddling is forbidden, no public begging because begging is forbidden, no public drunkenness, but it would have to be strict adherence to the law. If the law was not on the books, we were not to undertake any action. That is to say, no citizen may be touched or moved unless there is a legal reason for doing so. So I held the police very, very strictly to adherence to the law. That becomes a terribly important message to give to them, because if you're saying to them, get the people out of the way, make them invisible, move them off the streets. What are you really telling them? How do you move somebody off the street if you don't have the legal power to do so? So what I told them was to enforce the law. We would not allow structures that were illegal under our bridges or public begging or public drunkenness or public hawking and selling of wares or panhandling. And we did have a detoxification center to send them to. But the reality is that the government has abandoned the issue of creating a cheap, affordable housing. It has deinstitutionalized the mentally disturbed, many of whom ought to be institutionalized. We ought to have laws that permit the police to pick up someone that appears to be mentally disturbed to the point that it becomes a disturbance to those around them and taken to a psychiatric facility where they would be evaluated and possibly institutionalized involuntarily. Same with public drunks. We ought to be able to pick up public drunks on the street, take them to a detox center where they would be medically evaluated, dried up, cleaned up and sobered up and dried out and then released up no longer than 72 hours thereafter, picked up involuntarily. We do that in Minneapolis. I just don't think we're addressing these problems. We're trying to sweep them under the rugs, and police chiefs who want to survive and want to remain on the payroll and collect salary and being told how wonderful they are every day and the emoluments of power and all of that, basically accommodate, rather hypocritically, what are fundamentally illegal orders.
I don't know if you've experienced this in Minneapolis, but something I've been seeing in Philadelphia, and there's even been at least one newspaper story about this, is a new kind of crime that seems especially pointless. For instance, breaking into a car, leaving the expensive cassette machine, but stealing a couple of quarters for the parking, a couple of quarters that are in that little parking meter holder, in the car. Breaking into a grocery store, leaving some of the money in the, the money in the cash register, and taking a lot of Salem 100s, have you been seeing this kind of crime that seems to...
Yes, it's gratuitous, mindless vandalism and violence. And as our society moves deeper and deeper into this, this division of classes and the plight of the impoverished and the poor, you're going to see them strike out mindlessly is the only word that comes to mind.
Do you have any sense of why there seems to be this new kind of particularly gratuitous crime where something more valuable is left and something really cheap or inconsequential is taken and at great risk to the person? My other question is, what can police do about it? Is this something that police feel especially helpless about?
Well, at great risk to whom? And certainly not to the perpetrator, because we've tripled the prison population and there's no room at the inn for anybody, so an arrest is a meaningless sanction. We have 1/4 of our black males under some form of criminal control in this society. The leading cause of death of black males in this country is murder. The black males represent 6% of our population and over 40% of our prison population. And we're talking about what people might call the black problem, which in reality is a white problem that we refuse to face. What have they got to lose? I mean, what's the risk of punching out a window and reaching in and picking up some loose change? Where's the risk in that? They get arrested, they get caught, but nothing happens to them. So there isn't any particular risk. So when you say, gee, they're taking a big chance, you might be taking a big chance because you have been conditioned differently through your education and training to think in a middle-class sense of the sanctity of property. But if you had been a teenage black male who conditioned to violence and exclusion and racism and hopelessness, it's no more than picking up a blade of grass.
I think one of the serious problems in a lot of inner city communities is that there's an incredible distrust of the police.
Sure. Yes.
This feeling that the police are there to manage them, that a lot of the police are racist. And I wonder from your perspective, as a former police chief, if you think racism in the police force in the cities that you've worked, Minneapolis and New York City, is a real serious problem. And if it is a problem, what you could do to...
This is a racist society. Why shouldn't its institutions be racist? Of course the police are racist. And they have enormous power. Very often they're not even held to account for its use. So you're going to see racism at its very worst. And their assignment is to keep blacks down, to keep them out of sight, keep them in their place. That's the assignment. I mean, what do you think the Willie Horton debate was all about? It was about keeping blacks down. It was about racism. It's a racist society.
You say that the police, out of necessity, tend to stereotype.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the average cop has got to deal with 10 to 20 separate incidents every single day, very quickly. So he's got to, or she's got to, sort of size it up, make a decision, and act on that decision. 99 times out of 100, they will be right, but they will make mistakes. When they make mistakes, they're tragedies. That's the trouble, and that's the problem. But they will assess the attitude. Attitude is critical. The police are really giving you an attitude test. And if they size you, to them, there are only, you know, there are citizens and there are jerks. And if they define you as a jerk, that's not the phrase they use, something a little less delicate than that. If they define you as a jerk, you're in trouble. So they have to, they pull you over, they have to make a snap decision. They stop you on the street, they see you running, they're responding to a burglary, three people run out of a house, they've got to size you up. If it's three little old ladies with blue hair and fur coats running out of the house, that's one thing. If it's three black 15-year-old boys with sneakers, that's a different issue. They stereotype all the time, and they have to, and there's no way to avoid it, and all you can do is tell them to be cautious, not to overreact as they stereotype, but they must stereotype. Everyone does, anyway.
Let me ask you, you know, through your years as a police chief in Minneapolis, your wife was arrested several times for...
Six times.
For civil Six disobedience times. In and in anti-nuclear protests.
Yeah.
What effect did that have on you? Did the men on your force rib you about that, or...
Erica was arrested six times. She's a tremendous peace activist, a great believer in causes, and went to jail twice. And as far as I was concerned, I felt like Mrs. Mahatma Gandhi must have done. You know, I mean, Mahatma's up to his usual madness, and I just learned to live with it. I didn't much care what the cops felt. I got to be chief of police to do it my way, not their way, so I wasn't worried about what they felt.
Do you think it's harder now to be a cop than it's ever been before?
Yes, because of that subliminal message of keeping the underclass in its place. Before it was very straightforward. Make arrests, respond to calls, give tickets. Now they're being told, keep the underclass out of sight. The blacks, the homeless, the hungry, the naked. Keep them out of sight. We don't want to be bothered with them, but we don't have the laws to deal with them, and we don't have the institutions, but just keep doing it. That makes it very, very demoralizing and difficult. It's very ambiguous.
Are you glad to be off of the force now?
No. I loved what I did. I was grateful for it. Like Herman Melville, the police world was my Harvard and Yale. Loved every minute of it. Served as well as I could for 36 years, but 36 years was enough, and I got out of the way because I was in the way.
Anthony Boza, his new book is titled The Police Mystique. He's now Minnesota's gaming commissioner. Boza appears in the documentary film Police Chiefs, which will be shown on the PBS series POV during the week of July 31st. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If you think you need fancy beans and expensive brewing equipment to make the perfect cup of coffee, think again. Coming up, we talk with writer Corby Kummer. After 2 years of research, he's written a series of articles that dispel some common misconceptions about coffee. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording of two Schubert masses, one from near the start of the composer's career, the other from his final year. And Maureen Carrigan takes on the religion of baseball. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has announced that the U.S. will break off its 18-month-long dialogue with the PLO. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
Speaking at a news conference in Alabama, the president said his administration called on the PLO to condemn a May 30th seaborne guerrilla raid near Tel Aviv and to discipline the reputed mastermind of the raid, Abul Abbas. PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat did condemn terrorist actions against civilians, but he failed to mention the Tel Aviv raid or Abul Abbas. The president said the PLO has had ample opportunity to meet U.S. conditions for continuing the dialogue and could still salvage the peace process.
At any time that the PLO is prepared to take the necessary steps, we are prepared to promptly resume the dialogue.
A PLO spokesman in Tunis called the U.S. action an unfriendly and provocative act. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Nelson Mandela arrived in the United States today on his first visit and said the purpose of his trip to 13 countries is to say that sanctions against South Africa should not be lifted. In New York City, Mandela was given a ticker tape parade that some people on Broadway had waited for 5 hours to see. The leader of the African National Congress spent 27 years in prison for his fight against apartheid. He will spend 12 days in the U.S. and visit 8 U.S. cities. The legislature of the Soviet Republic of Uzbekistan has approved an act to make it a sovereign state, in the latest such move by the increasingly restless Soviet republics. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
The Uzbek declaration is little more than a political statement, but it reflects the growing trend here to assert some independence from Moscow. The Uzbek government had already moved to gain more control over its local economy, which is largely based on cotton production. Today's declaration reinforces those moves, but does not attempt to move Uzbekistan beyond Soviet control. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has announced plans to revamp the relationship between Moscow and the country's 15 republics, giving the republics greater authority to run their own affairs. But several republics refuse to wait. The Southern Republic of Georgia may be next to assert its sovereignty during a legislative session that opened today. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Two people are missing and 16 U.S. sailors are injured after a fire broke out on board the U.S. aircraft carrier Midway. The fire touched off demonstrations in the ship's home port in Japan, where city officials demanded that the Midway be barred from port until its safety has been confirmed. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 2 points to close at 2,895.05, on volume of some 137 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Schubert is most famous for his vocal works. He wrote hundreds of songs. But classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Schubert's most beautiful vocal music can be found in his lesser-known operas and church music. A new recording of two Schubert masses has just been released, conducted by Robert Shaw. Lloyd has this review.
Schubert's religious music is still among the least known bodies of work by any of the great composers. The two masses on this new Telarc album by Robert Shaw and the Atlanta Symphony come from opposite ends of Schubert's short career, and they exemplify the wonderful characteristics of each of these periods. The Mass No. 2 in G major was written in 1815 when Schubert was 18 years old. That was the year he composed nearly 150 songs, including The Erlking. Melodies just kept pouring out of him in songs and symphonies. The Mass No. 2 is one of the prettiest pieces of church music ever written. Here's soprano Dawn Upshaw, tenor David Gordon, and baritone William Stone in the Benedictus. Schubert wrote this Mass in only 6 days, and unlike his later work, he got to hear it performed almost immediately afterwards. The scale is small, the orchestra consists only of organ and strings, but there's a touching intimacy. Schubert's last Mass, number 6 in E-flat, is another matter. It comes from Schubert's last year, the year of Die Winterreise and Die Schwanengesang, the great C major symphony, the last three piano sonatas, and the profound, heartbreaking string quintet. He was 31. This Mass is on a grand scale, with some of Schubert's most complex choral writing. The orchestra includes winds and brass, no flutes or tubas, though, and timpani. Of course, the music is gorgeous and melodic, but also more searching, with a deeper sense of suffering. Here's the beginning of the powerfully chromatic Agnus Dei, perhaps Schubert's greatest and most explicit plea for mercy. The soloists are the sublime Benita Valente, mezzo-soprano Marietta Simpson, tenors John Humphrey and Glenn Siebert, and baritone Myron Myers. But the solo voices are far more thoroughly integrated with the chorus in this Mass, which means that the largest burden of the performance falls on the conductor. In the case of Robert Shaw, there's no need to worry. The flow of melody is beautifully shaped and heartfelt. The Atlanta Symphony and Chamber Chorus magnificently cover the full range from hushed mystery to full-throated splendor. Shaw's recordings of choral music on Telarc have now garnered no fewer than 10 Grammy Awards, but they are still excellent in spite of that. And this badly needed Schubert album is one of his very best.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Schubert, Mass No. 2 and Mass No. 6 on the Telarc label. This is Fresh Air. A good cup of coffee is one of the great small pleasures in life. That is, unless you've given it up for health reasons. After 2 years of research into coffee, Corby Kummer has written a series of articles on how to brew a truly pleasurable cup and what the latest medical research says about caffeine and decaffeination. Kummer's series on coffee is currently running in The Atlantic magazine. He's a senior editor and food columnist at The Atlantic and also writes about food for New England Monthly. I asked him first about the health effects of caffeine.
Like any chemical, caffeine has an effect on you. It makes you more alert. It makes you think faster, although not more clearly, unfortunately. It wakes you up. It does have an effect on you. Whether it's harmful, no, it's really not thought to be harmful. It's really up to you and your own sensitivity to it. Getting off caffeine can be really unpleasant, and almost everybody gets a bad headache that starts between 12 and 24 hours afterward and can last 2 to 3 days. That's very well documented, and there are lots of other things that are reported to be a bad result of caffeine withdrawal, the usual lethargy, inability to work effectively, loginess. So it can be unpleasant to go off it, but as far as actual risks, nobody's come up with much of anything.
If you're worried about digestive tract problems, whether it's ulcers or even urinary tract irritations, is there less of a problem associated with decaffeinated coffee than with caffeinated coffee?
Not really. This is unclear, but it turns out that both regular coffee and decaf have laxative effects and increase the secretion of gastric acids. So, in fact, much more powerfully than caffeine itself does and pure caffeine does. So it seems to be other acids in both caffeinated coffee and decaffeinated coffee.
A lot of women end up giving up coffee because they have fibrocystic breasts. They have these benign lumps in their breasts. And a lot of doctors recommend giving up coffee for it. What does the literature you've been reading have to say about coffee or decaffeinated coffee and fibrocystic breast problems?
I have to say that a lot of doctors, many fewer doctors recommend caffeine abstention than they used to, because there were a number of studies done, I think about 6 years ago, to see if there was lessening of fibrocystic disease when women gave up caffeine, and it wasn't statistically significant. And when those findings were released, doctors said, you might as well go back to having coffee because there doesn't seem to be a link to it. The evidence for it as an effective treatment seems mostly anecdotal.
Mm-hmm. But if you think that you have a problem that's getting better if you've given up coffee, I guess you should just trust that.
Yeah, and a lot of people think that problem has decreased once they've given it up.
Yeah.
There's nothing so far supports it.
Right.
But as with so many things with caffeine, it varies by individual, and it might well work for some women. There certainly seems to be no link to breast cancer, and there has been no link supported between coffee or caffeine and the actual development of fibrocystic disease.
Let's think about coffee and taste. What advice would you give us about what kinds of beans to buy and what kind of roast to buy when you're shopping for coffee?
So much advice. Oh, the first advice is freshness.
Mm-hmm.
That is more important than whether it's some fancy coffee or not. And it turns out that one of the very worst ways to get fresh coffee is to buy it from bins. Lucite bins in supermarkets and nice-looking jars, because there it's most exposed to air and heat, which are the enemies of freshness in coffee. And it might have been hanging around a long time. You're better off getting it from a can, as odd as that sounds. And you're very best getting it by mail order, by parcel post, because a lot of roasters, in fact, most roasters you order from, ship it to you the day it's roasted. And a lot of people think the best flavor is 2 days after roasting, 2 to 3 days after roasting, which is usually when you'll get it. Seattle seems to be the coffee capital of America, if not the world, these days. And a number of places like Starbucks and Caravali and Torrefazione Italia are becoming cults across the country. It's same with the Coffee Connection in Boston. So you call them up and you order coffee and you get a better choice and better freshness. If you have a place that's roasting it fresh in your town, support them. It's hard to stay in business, and they're giving you fresh coffee, too. And also, I found that dark roast isn't synonymous with sophistication the way I thought it was. It's good for espresso, which is really another kind of coffee, but it's not necessarily best for drip coffee, or it doesn't show off coffee best. Light roast can really show off the balance of liveliness and things that give it sparkle and flavor much better than a dark roast, which can mask those things. You're tasting charcoal, just like when you have a charred piece of grilled food. You love that carbon, but that's really what you're tasting, not the food. And it's the same thing with coffee.
You recommend grinding your coffee at home and grinding small amounts at a time so it's always fresh. What are the advantages of buying it as beans and grinding it at home?
Again, it's freshness. It keeps much better in the bean because the more surface area that's exposed to air and heat, the more it's going to lose flavor to the air, which you don't want it to. You should store coffee, all coffee, in airtight, opaque containers, best at room temperature. This freezing question is really controversial. It's only appropriate for whole beans, not ground. And it can dry them out, and they can lose flavor compounds that they'll never get back in defrosting. If you're going to save it for months, you might as well freeze it. But for a matter of weeks, you're probably better off at room temperature in a very airtight container. That's really the key.
So you don't recommend keeping that coffee in the freezer?
No, and I don't, certainly never in the refrigerator, which dries it out terribly, and it can absorb, it's very absorbent. I mean, instead of baking soda, some people used to recommend that it be used as a refrigerator freshener because it's so good at absorbing other flavors. So it's best to keep it out.
The most popular method of brewing nowadays are those, the drip method, where you drip into a pot and then the pot stays on a burner for
mm-hmm.
either 5 minutes or
hate
a full
that word,
day.
Burner. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, why do you hate burners?
That's the worst thing that you can do to coffee.
Uh-huh.
As it turns out, with the widespread surrender of the home percolator, which is a pretty terrible way to make coffee, once Mr. Coffee elbowed it out in the early 70s, we went to the method restaurants have been using for years, which is filter coffee, and that's a wonderful way of making coffee. Although I think that you're much better off if you buy a metal filter to substitute for the paper, because a lot more of the oils that give body and some flavor, but certainly body to coffee, come through a metal filter. That's true percolation, by the way. When coffee goes over grounds that are in a metal filter, paper is filtration. However, the enemy of coffee all over America is keeping it on a burner, because it oxidizes a lot of the flavor compounds. Many of them just vaporize away in that steam. And what you're getting is something kind of bitter, sour, and unpleasant. So what you should do is transfer it to an insulated pitcher container, a thermos kind of container. That's the kindest thing that any restaurant can do to coffee, because they're making it. They don't need any more expensive equipment. If you have an automatic drip machine or an old hardware drip machine, a hardware store one, they're great. There's really, you can't do better, but don't keep it on a burner.
What do you think of those new, they're new to me anyways, infusion pots, where basically the grounds sit in hot water and then you filter them out after it's brewed?
Oh, I'm not wild about those. Those are the plunger pot, also called Melior, for the most famous French manufacturer. And they've been kind of a chic staple item in gourmet restaurants and homes for years now, for at least 20 years. They look great because they have this 1920s design that makes you think that Hemingway is next to you at the De Mago in Paris. And a lot of people swear by them. Infusion is a perfectly good way to make coffee. It's kind of the sophisticated way of making camp coffee, cowboy coffee. I don't like it very much. I find that there's too much infusion left, even with the genuine French models, which have a much better screen that screens out the sediment. They're very expensive, and so most people get the imitations, which allow a lot more grounds through it. The coffee's cold by the time it's done, and when you're plunging that screen down through the water and grounds mixture, it can take a lot of force because there's a tremendous amount of surface tension. But a lot of people are really loyal to this method, and what they should be doing is using a coarse grind and a lot of it, more than you would think. That's the best way of making plunger pot. I'm just not wild about it.
Well, you've been researching coffee and drinking a whole lot of very good and very bad coffee as part of this research for at least 2 years now. Mm-hmm. Has your approach to making or drinking or buying coffee changed as a result of the research that you've been doing?
Yeah, it turned out that a lot of the snobbery I thought I was going to adopt enthusiastically was completely misplaced. That freshness is much more important than some fancy kind. That going out and spending money on Kona or Jamaica Blue Mountain, you're probably wasting it because it's probably not those genuine things or in a pure form. Also, to use enough coffee. Use those coffee scoops to 6 ounce cups. It's 2 tablespoons to a 6 ounce cup, and that makes a lot of difference.
You drink decaf, right?
I drink quantities of decaf, quarts of it.
Why did you switch to decaf?
Because I'm one of those people who's extremely sensitive to caffeine. I mean, I could be propelled across the country from one cup of coffee, but I love the taste of the stuff.
Well, Corby Cummer, thanks a lot for talking with us about coffee.
Thank you.
Corby Cummer, his series on coffee continues in the July issue of The Atlantic.
I'm feeling mighty lonesome, haven't slept a wink. I walk the floor and watch the door, and in between I drink black coffee.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, how are you covering Nelson Mandela's arrival in New York?
Well, correspondent Margot Adler covered the arrival today, and she'll be reporting on it. Also, Ted Clark in Washington has prepared a report on the debate over sanctions against South Africa. Should they be held in effect, as Mr. Mandela has been urging, or lifted in response to the liberalizations of the government there? We'll also be hearing about President Bush's announcement suspending the U.S. dialogue with the PLO, and a talk with Joel Garrow of the Washington Post. He's of an old French-Canadian family, and he says as long as Canada's about to disintegrate, let's figure out which parts we want and which parts we don't want.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Summer is the season for baseball and books about baseball, but critic Maureen Carrigan says she's tired of both.
2 summers ago, I went to what I vowed will be my last baseball game. It was my birthday, and the baseball nut in my life invited me to Shea Stadium to see the Mets. He wanted to teach me the game again. My birthday present, he promised, would be that I would finally understand baseball. Of course, when we got to the stadium, he immediately turned his attention to the game. So there I was, stuck watching something I don't understand, while my Virgil had turned into an Ahab, screaming at the sight of the great white ball. I need a beer, I told him. When I finally reached the snack counter, I told the woman there that it was my birthday. She sized up the situation instantly and said, I'd kill him, honey. To me, watching baseball is as suspenseful as waiting for a bead of sweat to drop off your nose on a summer afternoon. But that isn't my biggest gripe. No, the worst thing about baseball is that it turns the prose of otherwise fine writers into sentimental mush. This year's big baseball book is George Will's Men at Work. Will's thesis is that baseball demands extraordinary discipline and mental ability, qualities you may not immediately recognize in grown men who call themselves Sparky, Mookie, and Nails. Will romanticizes the players as noble craftsmen, happy in their work. What he doesn't acknowledge is that most of us would be happy in our work, too, if we were making $600,000 a year. That's the current average salary for major leaguers. But the worst is when Will compares baseball to a religious experience. He writes that baseball is good for the individual soul and hence for society. 19th century social reformers made the same claims about the uplifting effects of reading Shakespeare to the insane. To try to find out what all the fuss is about, I've sometimes read Roger Angel in The New Yorker. But I always feel like I've sat through the full 162-game season after I've read one of his endless articles. This spring's piece opened with an extended metaphor that likened the game of baseball to a chivalric quest. Even Charles Kuralt, that gruff walrus, gushes about baseball. Last Sunday morning, he paid homage to Nolan Ryan, who at 43 can still toss a ball to a batter. Kuralt rumbled out a Yeats poem about old age in Ryan's honor. Okay, but what about all those women who go through childbirth in their 40s? Don't they deserve any primetime poetry? Oh, I could go on. There's Bill James. His snappy style is buried under lists of mystical baseball statistics. And then the late A. Bartlett Giamatti. Whenever he talked about baseball, he sounded like he was reading from his old Yale lecture notes on Renaissance Lit. Only commentator Red Barber has grown beyond this silly, macho need to erect a cosmic scaffolding around a leisure time diversion. Why, the old redhead doesn't even follow the game anymore. Instead, he'd rather talk about the Florida weather. In his 80s, Red has discovered what all these younger guys still need to learn. It's only a game.
Maureen Carrigan teaches at Georgetown University. And by the way, Maureen, our director Chris Bergen wants equal time. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air, with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Dan Buskirk. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist Reginald McKnight on being an African-American in Africa. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker on the man who created New Kids on the Block, and film critic Stephen Schiff on the new movie Gremlins 2. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.